Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. I'm Hayley Roy, a commercial interior designer with a passion for creating beautiful functional spaces. Over the years, I've worked on a variety of projects and I've accumulated a wealth of knowledge, which I'm excited to share with you. I started this podcast because I believe in the power of interior design. So much of what we need to know as designers, you won't learn in a classroom. Whether you're an aspiring designer, tackling your home project, or a seasoned pro, this podcast is for you. Season 2 is here, and I couldn't be more thrilled to kick things off with some fresh energy and exciting changes. This season, I'm joined by not one, but two incredible co-hosts, Hannah Denny and Scarlett Mallett. Together, we're diving deeper into the world of design to bring you more perspectives, lively debates, and all the tips and tricks you need to thrive. We're here to offer practical advice, discuss the latest trends, and give you unfiltered, real-world insights. Expect honest conversations, a bit of humour, and maybe even the occasional strong opinion and language. Remember, if it's not fun, we're not doing it. And if you're a sound editor looking for a fun collaboration, let us know. We'd love to have you on board. Thanks for tuning in to Season 2 of the Interior Design Podcast. Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. Today, we are hosted by Platform Events at the O2 Intercontinental Hotel. And it is the Interior Design and Architecture Summit at the moment. And we've been doing some speed dating with suppliers.
Yeah.
20-minute meetings with Platform Events, which we do every year and thoroughly enjoy.
Yeah. You get carried away because you want to speak to so many people, but that is what the evening is for. So,
yeah, we had a lovely night last night and had a nice dinner and
you really get a lot of opportunities being at this event, which I love. Oh, we do it most years, don't we, Hayley?
So, yeah. And behind us is the Thames and we are joined by the amazing Richard Evans from Carney Sweeney. Did I say that right?
You did too. Yes. Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to just introduce Richard by saying that I met him on a job that we were doing together. And one of the reasons that I invited him on the podcast was because he was extremely eloquent in the way that he spoke to the client and explained things in such a way that I thought that everybody who listens to the podcast would benefit it. So we're talking about UK planning. And let you introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. So I'm a qualified town planner. I'm a member of the Royal Town Planning Institute, the RTPI, but anybody can call themselves a planner through the decision-making process. So I have been practicing for 25 years, and it's an important distinction, as you often hear people being referred to as the planner's made a decision to approve or refuse this. It's not just the actual qualified planners, town planners who are called planners, planning committee members who have no, perhaps, qualification whatsoever, other than a bit of training to be on the committee. They are planners and they make that decision. So I have 12 years experience at local authority. Following that, I worked for a property developer for 4 years. So I gained a commercial awareness and time imperative appreciation for the implications for any bureaucratic delays on program and delivery. But I have been working as a planning consultant for the last 9 years. Advising private clients and navigate their way through the planning process. And this can include from site acquisition, formulation of design concepts, formulation of the planning applications. And this involves including liaison with council planners and other stakeholders in advance of the submission. We do a lot of post-approval work as designs can change once the builders get on site and the client gets on site and really gets to grips with what can actually be achieved. It's not always what they have planning permission for. So a lot of design changes occur, which will need to go back to planning. And we guide the clients on how to best minimize any delays through that process. So I deal with a broad range of planning applications. And in 2 weeks, I have a planning application going forward to committee for 1,900 homes. And developments include buildings up to 33 stories in height. But by contrast, earlier this week, I submitted a plan application that included primarily for a new door in the shopfront. in a conservation area. So it's a broad range of planning application work that we do.
And you also used to be a DJ, didn't you?
No.
The reason that just to explain, if you can see it on YouTube, he's wearing like his headphones without it being on one of his ears.
I'm just used to listening to the music through one ear and in the headphones and what's going out the speakers the other. I've never been a professional DJ anyway, shape or form. I'm a bedroom DJ.
Bedroom That's DJ. Sorry if I outed you then.
I'm available for bookings.
So what made you go into planning in the first place?
Oh, that's a very good question. I always appreciated and loved the makeup of towns, how they evolved in certain areas, why certain areas were what they did, why they did what they did. Maybe they residential and the intensification in residential areas and how they interacted with the commercial areas and routes through that people take and the human interaction. Planning covers the social, economic, and the physical as the three tenets of planning. They're all interlinked. So you can it's an assessment of what influences what, but I was always fascinated by towns. So we were discussing earlier on, I'm a country boy. I was brought up in a house in the field on the side of a valley in Wales, and my father was a farmer. I thought it was a curse. I just wanted to live in towns and cities and see how they evolve because there was so much action going on there. And I'm interested in politics as well. And they're very much interlinked. And planning in the environment were the obvious choice. And I've never regretted it. Although, if I was a professional DJ, I would have obviously been happy with that route.
So being in the countryside and on the farm with your family, you were always interested in sightseeing within the bigger towns?
Very much so. And we had an annual trip to come and see my auntie and uncle and my cousins in London. And I always look forward to that and really enjoyed that and soaked all in. But town planning affects the countryside just as much as it does the towns as well. And I've been a planning officer in rural authorities and green belts, countryside, dealt with agricultural buildings, etc. as well. So it applies everywhere. It's not prejudice where it intervenes and causes bureaucracy.
So you say that it applies everywhere, but would you say you get more work with it? The cities rather than the countryside?
We deal with a broad range of queries. I've just attended an appeal hearing this week for an alleged development within the greenbelt, within the countryside, outside of town. It's on the boundary in close proximity to the town. But we do a broad range of work. A lot of inquiries will come from people who are looking to develop in the countryside. And that's becoming more and more prevalent and will do going forward with changes to national planning policy on potential new towns and developments in the greenbelt, in the countryside, as well, or on the periphery of towns, where the opportunities are to deliver more housing and more commercial developments. So we deal a lot of queries in the countryside as well, not just urban areas. We're based in London, we do a lot of work within London as well.
Yeah. So in the context of interior design, how would you define planning?
The geeky bit. I think it's important to lay out. Okay. So development is what we refer to. And development is defined in the Town and Country Planning Act. So development requires planning permission. I'll read out to you the section 55, if you're making notes of the Act. And that states that development is defined as the carrying out of building, engineering, mining, or other operations in, on, or under land, or the making of any material change in the use of any buildings or other land. So that sets out in statute the position. The Act also goes on to identify that certain operations or uses of land are not classed as development, which is very important. And these comprise primarily of the carrying out for the maintenance, improvement, or alteration otherwise of any building of works, which affect only the interior of a building, or do not materially affect the external appearance of the building. There are other exemptions that apply as well, such as incidental to the enjoyment of a dwelling house. And that can range from working from home in your office and you comply with certain criteria, or even the keeping of animals in your back garden, such as keeping horses or hens, for example. So there's lots of definitions there, and it is very legal.
So if I want some chickens, I need to apply for planning permission for them?
No, providing that they are in connection with the enjoyment of your dwelling. If you're operating a commercial business there, for those in connection with those hens, that's when the tipping point would be an assessment of change of use would occur.
So if you had eggs and you had too many eggs and you sold them for a pound out the front, at that point they become a business.
It would be a matter of fact and degree, which is a key phrase in town planning. An assessment would be made. Okay, what are the characteristics of that? If you are setting a stall up and if you're employing someone, and if you're getting deliveries and the van's turning up, picking things, picking up eggs and dropping off egg boxes on a regular basis, and you've got lots of people traveling within their cars and coming and causing a noise and disturbance and parking everywhere, that would be characteristic of a business taking place because it has an impact on your neighbours and on the parking in the locale and the highway safety and all these issues that would need to be considered under a planning application. If you're doing it once a month, 1 hour, and you're, you know, you're not employing anybody, that would be ancillary.
Yeah,
I would suggest.
What does ancillary mean?
Oh God!
thank you very much for putting me on the spot there. That's it's a very good question. That's something which isn't defined as being a significant difference to what you would normally anticipate or expect to take place at the primary use. It, in itself, it can be quite a large use. For example, a hotel is a good case in point. It might have a restaurant that members of the public can visit, but proportionately, it's not a significant component of the use. It doesn't change the balance significantly. Majority of people will be coming from the hotel for purposes of the use in connection with staying at the hotel and the deliveries associated with that. It may get members of the public coming and visiting who are not guests, but it would be seen proportionately part of the wider use, I would suggest. So we would be maintaining a hotel, albeit one with an external restaurant. So that would be an ancillary use in connection with the main use.
It's quite interesting to think that so many people do that.
Working from home is the classic and best example, particularly now, obviously, post the pandemic. People work from home, they'll set up a desk there. That's ancillary. So I think it's the most classic example of an ancillary activity there. If you were employing people who were coming and having to park their cars there, for example, if you're getting deliveries, you're having collections, and if you're having members of the public or customers visiting, the balance shifts, balance changes there. Mm. It would become mixed use because you're still living there.
Oh, I used to do that. I didn't know that you needed planning for that.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
Just told everyone.
Sorry, universe.
I don't do it anymore. If you've ceased to use it in my house. Yeah, you cease to use. So that's a really better example than the egg sale.
Yeah.
So why is planning permission and understanding the regulations so crucial for interior designers?
It really is critical. You have implications, what it may mean on program and delivery. The worst case scenario is carrying out work which requires planning permission. You'll have an enforcement officer potentially knocking on the door following receipt of a complaint of something so obvious that they've observed themselves. And that's going to, you know, any such intervention is going to be problematic for the operator or the owner of the site anyway. But it's best legally to get all your papers in order because you never know when that's going to cause a problem, be it in financing an operation at a future date or if you're looking to sell or dispose of anything. If it's found that the appropriate planning permission isn't in place, that is going to have ramifications on the value, obviously, and delays. But whilst works are taking place, obviously, there's an investment there which hasn't been authorised potentially. So it is critical that the appropriate consents are put in place and everyone's comfortable with that.
So when I go into a property, I would check the planning on that property.
So we would always recommend you take a look at council's website. They are a great resource. Each planning authority will have their planning section on their website where you can take a look there at the planning history of the site. And it's one of the first things that we do if anyone makes an inquiry about a particular site and suggests they want to do something there. You take a look at the planning history and you'd also take a look at the planning policy. You've got to assess whether planning permission is required, whether it is development. When you are doing that, you should take a look at the planning history of the property because the planning permission may be in place originally, but on historical planning permissions, there may well be conditions as well. So you need to burrow a little bit deeper into look for the decision notice. Take a look at the conditions. There might be a restrictive condition on there. That's ordinarily what you may wish to carry out would be perfectly acceptable, what you may look to do. there may be a restrictive condition on there that prevents that. So I'd always take a look at the planning decision and get in full receipt of the facts of what's going on there. But you need to establish whether planning permission is required, first of all. It's not just planning permission on developments. If a property is listed, the store really listed, and you can check the Historic England website, they keep the list of all the buildings which are listed and its grading. And the reason why it's listed as well can be for its architectural quality or for its historic value. It's such an important area to take a look at and seek confirmation of. So the local planning authority's website is the key resource you take.
Where would you use the planning portal? Because there's a portal that covers the whole country, isn't there?
That's right, yeah. You would need to use the planning portal to submit planning applications and listable consent applications.
So the information isn't actually there, is it? Because I always go on the planning portal and then I end up, and then it takes me to the authority.
That's right. So you just punch in the local authority planning policy or planning application search and you will find that information there. So local planning authorities should have an adopted plan. We should talk about the development plan. And that's made up of the local authority's plan itself, but also there's the National Planning Policy Framework as well. And in London, we have the Strategic London Plan, which has further policy as well. We would always take a look at the local authority's website for their local plan, which may, depending on when it was adopted, may comprise a few different documents, and there will be a policies map on there as well. So you can physically take a look at your site, and you can take a look at if there are any designations on it. So it may be in a conservation area. It might be in town centres. You have the town centres are defined as well, which has a link to applicable policies. There may be primary shopping frontages, secondary shopping frontages, and those can affect the types of use that the local authority would accept there as well. And the importance of that street within the town centre and the commercial centre has. So there's all a myriad of policies will be designated on there, such as green belts as well.
So how would you say planning affects interior design projects? For example, if you go against commercial versus residential?
You need to satisfy all the planning policies. They have the same means to an end. Obviously, commercial clients and instructions will have a tight time frame, and they'll have funding behind them, and they'll have an opening date by which the purpose of their existence kicks in and they get the return on the money, so on the investment. So planning can delay program, and that's a key aspect there. I think it's imperative that at an early stage, the clients, be they commercial or residential, they're given full receipt of the position when planning comes into play.
Yeah.
So they're aware what they're letting themselves in for, what the requirements are going to be, so they can assess risk themselves. We take our instructions from clients and they're the decision makers. They'll be informed by our advice and our guidance, but to properly research what are the implications for anything is imperative.
Yeah.
Because they're interwoven and they're not just controlled by planning, which is secondary legislation, but you have other influences as well. You have secured by design, you have the fire safety regulations, you have wheelchair accessibility requirements. Used to be, it's now part M of the building regulations. It used to be DDA, the Disabled Discriminatory Act. So there's all those things at play which will come into effect. And I'm sure you guys are fully aware of the ramifications for those.
Yeah.
And you've got planning as well. And you'll bring it to the fore when applications are being scrutinized at planning application stage.
Yeah.
So there may be the need for you to include specialist consultants as well who can advise on these things. Daylight sunlight, for example, can affect new schemes, new house builds, etc., for example, and where the target standards that are required to meet daylight sunlight standards. So they'll affect layouts, interior of the rooms, proximity to the windows, and you may come up with solutions to insert a high-level window or even a skylight.
Yeah.
To address that. But there are daylight sunlight specialists and that can advise as well.
Daylight sunlight is...
That's a measure of what the level, reasonably expected levels of internal daylight within a room.
And is there standards that you have to meet?
So BRE set out guidelines and new guidelines were published 2 years ago. They are guidelines, so they're not absolutely prescriptive that you must meet those. The planning process is a process of judging the planning balance. So going back to the local plan, if you come for a moment, the development plan, the aspiration, the requirements is that you meet the planning, the local plan as a whole. But there are priorities within the local plan. So yeah. Not all policies will always be met all of the time. We don't live in that world.
Yeah.
Planning officers, when you speak with them, will always aspire and seek to push you and drive you to each of those. That's their job. But a planning balance at the end of the day will need to be derived. What are the important things? What are the restrictions on the site? What are the benefits? What's the justification for what you're proposing? So something may be in conflict with policy, but there may be an overriding benefit and other primary policies are being met. So the planning officers always pursue those as the primary objective. So they come in when we're dealing with daylight sunlight. So it's a policy will be in there typically that daylight sunlight must be met. BRE guidelines will be the go-to benchmark, but then different levels of daylight and levels of sunlight as well, which are the two different things, are targeted. And they are targets prescribed for different rooms within residential properties. And also what the impact on overshadowing is on the neighbouring properties by a new construction as well. So typically those will be assessed on large developments, not all units, as we call them, or homes or rooms will always meet all the targets all the time. That's impossible.
Yeah.
But a large proportion of them should do. And there should be a justification why. And then the balance is struck then.
Why do we have that in place, daylight, sunlight? Is it something to do with mental health?
Well, in planning terms, it would be amenity. That is the catch-all phrase that covers a lot of different aspects. Amenity is the enjoyment, your enjoyment, essentially, and the quality of that place. So amenity can apply to the visual amenity. So a new build or installing a new shopfront will have implications on the townscape and the street scene, the character of an area, and that will be assessed. And if a planning officer in their planning speak in the assessments are not happy with that, they will advise that it's injurious to the enjoyment of the visual amenity of a location. So amenity can also apply to individuals' enjoyment of their dwelling house. It's a carefully crafted phrase that can catch a few different aspects, considerations as well. And it's not a science, it is an art. On judgments, planning judgments and balance.
So it's interesting you saying that. We worked on a project at the start of the year and it was planning for a window. It's really important to know that planning can take so long. One thing that I can say that I've definitely learned, get that planning done as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And what we really had to take into consideration, like you were saying, was about the natural light. As well as the natural light, we had to make sure about the window, how much you could open it, because facing it, there were people's apartments. You really have to take so much into account with planning. Like, it already sounds complicated. A lot goes into it. And there's so many things you need to take into account. But one thing that I have definitely learned is get started on doing your planning as soon as possible. Mm. That is one thing that I really have learned within this industry. And Hayley could probably agree with me, so can you.
Absolutely.
It's so important.
Absolutely. And you touched on a classic example there. You may achieve improved daylight sunlight internally, but you're going to look into someone's, which would mean it would be unacceptable. But there's then mitigation that you can have, as you said.
There's things that you can do.
Limit the opening of that window, obscure glazing.
Yeah.
Needs to be a certain level. But then the aesthetic, the design of that window, and how it appears in the street scene and the context of the building, again, are important.
You've got to make sure that the planning doesn't implicate the design, but also the design doesn't implicate the planning getting approved. And so there's so much to consider.
Absolutely, absolutely. The sooner you have an understanding of what the implications are, what the brief is, what the aspiration is, and have the appropriate people in the room to advise and guide you on that design evolution, that design inception stage. And it's important that the client's aware of that as well, the journey that they may have to go on. Clients naturally don't want to hear about any problems. They want to accelerate the process and get the operational activity underway. But to accelerate too quickly, then you're going to trip yourself up and it'll become worse further down the line. That's the issue. And the frustration kick in then because of the design implications, program, delivery and cost, the budget as well. And once people, clients have a fixed view on cost, they don't want to hear about any more problems or additional costs, any burdens. That just leads to further stress and the relationship. So it's really to forward plan as much as possible, get cracking with what will be required. So if you need to submit a planning application, you need to go on the council's website, take a look at the policies and appreciate what the policies may be, but also you need to take a look at the validation checklist and that list what types of reports and assessments are required for a planning application. Those can be prepared and you get those experts involved in the process at an early stage to give you their brief and their requirements. So you're presenting a list of deliverables as early as possible. What needs to be covered, but what they need to cover as well, what they need to include. And there can be so many that are interwoven and interdependent as well. And liaison between those consultants. So with a planning application, you want to get that as future-proofed as possible.
Yeah. I have a question. Some interior designers are applying for planning, and I have had some pub group clients expect that as part of our brief, and I've stopped doing it now. I've stopped applying for planning permission, basically, right, because I'd much rather ring Richard and say, help. The reason for it is that I took on a advertising consent planning application in Westminster.
Oh, yeah.
Right outside Leicester Square. And actually, the client has stopped paying me to do it. And I don't think they've actually got planning. I don't think they've done it. And I ended up calling a friend of mine before I met you, Richard, a guy called Robert Pomeroy, who's a local. And he gave me loads of advice and told me what to do, because I was just like,
yeah,
Westminster Council just chucking out everything I was giving them. And then I went back to the client and said, you need to pay me to do more drawings because the council need all these other drawings, and they didn't want to pay anymore. So it just died a death, really.
But that's going to have an implication on you as well, isn't it? In a sense, I feel like if by them not paying you, it's made an implication because you're trying to help them with the planning and they're stopping that. So it's
the client's choice, isn't it? Would you be responsible for informing the council?
The council will leave the onus on the landowner.
Client, yeah. It's up to them. If he doesn't want it, if they don't want to pay me to do it.
So would it not implicate the designer because they've been appointed for it?
No. The local authority, they may seek to get in contact with you if they can't get in contact with the landowner or the management company in the first place, the clients. But if they see something that's potentially unauthorised, and you know, Westminster's one of the largest authorities, because of the amount of commercial applications they get for the signage and the like. I mean, it's a very difficult task to keep up with everything, but they have one of the largest enforcement teams as well, historically. But yes, they would take that up with the operator.
So the client, they can't just turn around and go, well, we've put our designer in charge, when realistically, behind the scenes, it's...
I've got a paper chain as well to say this is what is
to get planning permission. I need more drawings,
and you haven't provided.
And I need you to pay me to do the drawing, so therefore you need to pay me to do this. Or you know, I don't know what they've done. They might have gone to a planning consultant, but yeah. So that sort of just went away in the end. But I spent so much time on that. Yeah. But what happened was there was the existing fascia when we took over had not got planning permission either. So what was in the planning was the previous person, but they wanted drawings of, they kind of wanted the history. So they wanted me to draw up what was existing.
Yep.
So photographs and things like that weren't enough. They wanted me to draw all of that up. And then they wanted the further changes. So it was like almost like a three phase.
Yeah.
And that was the problem, because it hadn't got planning previously. And I think that's why the client just went, well, the guy before me didn't get any planning and he didn't get told off. So
you can,
it's like, I'll ask for forgiveness, not permission, you know? And that's what they ended up doing.
You can see why a lot of commercial operators will say, well, if we hadn't told the planners in the first place, we'd have just gone ahead and done it and no one would say anything anyway. Lots of that goes on. That's planning risk for you, isn't it? That's a commercial decision by the client. I've dealt with precisely the scenario you're talking about there. I had to explain to the client why we're submitting these drawings and what needs to be done. Yeah. because the original, the historical use would be the lawful, sorry, the historic shop front would be the lawful shop front. But in context to what is you're proposing, you will need to provide a drawing of what's there at the moment. Whether or not it's lawful or not is the question. But it's what you're proposing will be judged on its merits against what the lawful shopfront is, and whether it's an improvement on that. So a lot of the time, something in its own right may not satisfy the local design officer. And in addition to local planning policy, always on council's websites for supplementary planning guidance, which are not adopted policy, but they'll give you an indication of precisely what the council are looking for. And they often have them on historic shop fronts, for example, or design guidelines. So it's a very important field for you to research. But they will assess what you're proposing against what the fallback position is of what has been there and what is lawful. And you may achieve an improvement on that. So they will take that. They may try and negotiate changes to it. And that's where that relationship and that conversation with the planners comes into it. But if you can demonstrate an improvement, you're in a strong position. If you can't achieve planning policy, the idealized view of what the shop front, for example, or the fascia sign should look like.
So Richard, for people that aren't aware, what are the implications for if you do not get planning permission and you just carry on with what you wanted to submit?
So each planning department will have an enforcement team, and they will do the investigations, and they're a busy team. There's a lot of people who do things innocuously a lot of the time. That's naivety. We're carrying out work which they haven't got planning permission for. So that often relies upon members of the public or councillors to issue a complaint, and an officer will come out on site and investigate that and assess, do you need planning permission for what you're doing? And should you submit a planning application? Sometimes they deduce it's not actually expedient to pursue enforcement action, but they do have it within their gift and their powers to issue enforcement notices ultimately, which is a statutorily binding notice requiring you to what you're doing, potentially return the site back to its former use or its physical appearance. They can't be too prescriptive in returning some elements sometimes, but that's a legal debate. But essentially, yes, they can insist that you stop what you're doing and restore a building, particularly if something is listed, which has a higher degree of importance, and most definitely. But enforcement and powers do exist. It's unlawful. It's not illegal. So the police won't come down and take you away, and you will be prosecuted by the police or the Crown Prosecution Service. But the council does have the powers to pursue enforcement action. They can issue a stop notice. That means you must forthwith stop what you're doing and wait until an enforcement notice is issued, and then you go through that process. They can also issue fact-finding questionnaires. They're known as planning contravention notices. They're often used to establish who is the landowner and who is the developer. Those two people are the people who are usually pinned on, not the consultants who are involved in this process. So you are not doing anything significant unless it's a listed building, and then everybody is on the gangplank then. But if you do receive enforcement investigation, it is a serious affair, and it's something you wish to be avoiding as much as possible. That does occur. You should always seek to be as collaborative with the council as possible. Feign ignorance if need be, but always say, well, we want to do the right thing here.
Yeah.
The onus is on the client at the end of the day. They're issuing the instructions. And if something people don't feel comfortable with, obviously you make a commercial decision on your involvement in that project, don't you?
Mm. I have a question. You don't just work with one council, do you?
No, not at all. Anywhere.
You work with lots of different councils.
Yes.
Is it useful to know people in the planning office? Because you've obviously worked in the planning office and then come to the dark side.
Relationship building is key. Lots of the queries that we will have and inquiries from prospective clients will be, do we have experience in a particular authority? It's not just to know how they react or what they want or what are the must-haves there or the deal breakers or the things that they can negotiate on. It's how they operate. Can you pick the phone up to someone? Have you got that direct line with someone to have those conversations? And it goes back to relationship building at the end of the day. If you've got experience with people, that really benefits them, the level of those conversations you can have.
Yeah.
I'm a great believer in meeting people face-to-face wherever possible. Meetings via Teams have been brilliant and do speed up the process and enable people to have that conversation on some elements. But nothing can beat meeting. You build up that relationship with them. People may appear a bit standoffish initially, but if you were involved in a series of workshops, design workshops or pre-application inquiries with an officer, you have that opportunity to have those conversations at the side of the meeting, I think, and just develop a rapport so you can gain a sense of the importance of some elements of what they're discussing. So obviously where we have a history of dealing with planning applications in certain boroughs in London or in different councils, and you have that background knowledge of how they operate and what their reaction will be. So in the conversation, when hopefully you have a bit of more of a direct track to them, you can sound them out about certain aspects, because a lot of innuendo is given in advice.
Yeah.
It can be subtle, there's nuances. I used to do that when I was a planning officer.
I think you're saying the word innuendo in a different way to what I understand. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think about that differently. And we were talking about earlier, weren't we, Richard? I feel like it makes the work and job easier to complete.
The ideal world is when you're working with people you get on with.
Yeah.
You're all on the same page. You've all got the same approach and understanding and appreciation and respect for each other's roles in that process, in building that team. A bit of a cliche, but... it's all about the delivery, isn't it? Of a successful outcome at the end of the day, not to be that ambulance chaser. So you've got the respect of the clients and you're giving them advice, you're giving them heads up, you're identifying those risks as early on as possible, letting them know what they're letting themselves in for, A, B, and C. These things might cost money, just letting you know.
Yeah.
How far are you willing to go down that route? What are the commercial imperatives that you have? Are you listening to everything else that the specialists and consultants are saying? You want people who've got your back, don't you? And you want to you want to show people you've got their back as well, not dropping them in it. Because we're all in it for the same purpose, but there's a delivery and aspiration, a great job satisfaction that's derived from those successful outcomes.
Yeah.
And hopefully generates repeat work, because in the future date, those other consultants that you've worked with or the other client that you've worked with will make a recommendation to people who they work with and say, that person knows how to get a successful outcome within that authority, within that barrier.
I think people really respect when you tell them the truth, when you give them that feedback, work with them, be neat. So
what advice, Richard, would you give designers on navigating the complexities of planning permission?
Well, as I said, it's the research, establish if planning permission is required, if listed builder consent is required, that's as early stage as possible, because that's going to affect delivery and program, isn't it? And even if you think planning permission isn't required, I mentioned before, do your planning history search on that website. Take a look at the planning decision notices. There may be a planning application that is required and you think this is going to go straightforward. This should be fine. They may have had planning permission refused 3 years ago or recently on the site. There may be something that triggers the alarm bells. A lot of the time on the council's website, there'll be the officer's report. That is their explanation of the proposals, setting out the planning policy, what the context is, what the material considerations are, what the consultation responses are. There may be on an application, which you would think would be pretty straightforward, may have generated a great deal of local objections. It might be particularly contentious. You might be revisiting something again that the local residents may well have felt that they've punctured, they've dealt with that. The pitchforks have been out. They served their purpose and they've been put away again. Don't darken our door with that idea again.
Yeah.
And you revisit it again. So send down information in the officer's report if it's published. And some application may have been to committee as well. So there's a whole host of information and background research that you can do there. Speak to the planners if it's possible. There's duty planners. They should be accessible. They may not be very experienced, the duty planners, but you would hope that you can have a conversation with them just to sound something out. Now, they may direct you to submitting a pre-application inquiry, which will cost money, lead to delay, but it is a valid process. Depends on the instruction and the clients. They want to do things properly and have got a bit of time, because you can get bogged down in bureaucracy and delays, but you can go down that route as well of putting a pre-application inquiry You only get out of those inquiries, those questions with the council, what you put into it. What information are you supplying, and what are the questions you're putting to them?
So what's a pre-application?
So before you submit a planning application, you can put something in writing to the council to give you an informal response.
Like, I'm looking at doing this kind of thing.
Precisely. Right. Do I need planning permission? A lot of the time, they will tell you, no, you don't need planning permission for that. It won't be a legally binding response. It's the informal, all the caveats will be on there, the disclaimers. Informal opinion of an officer, because until you see a decision notice in black and white, nothing is guaranteed in town planning. And even after the decision is given, people have a 6 weeks window to challenge the process. Are you aware? And if it needs money to challenge it. But it has to be on process, the protocols and procedures, and the law hasn't been abided by in the delivery of that decision and that assessment. But you can submit a pre-application inquiry. There's a fee with it. You can include drawings. You can provide some reports as well to support the proposal. The local authority then may come back to you and say, oh, there's a lot here. We want to enter into an agreement. Then there's a planning performance agreement. Avoid those if you can, because they cost more money and lead to more delays. Bit of a revenue earning process for the local authority. But they do serve an important process, providing them to speak with the planners informally. They can give you a list of what you require to submit a planning application as well, what the policy should be, which is very useful, although you should always do your own research as well. And they can give you a background. They might tell you, people have been applying for this for the last 10 years, you've got no chance whatsoever. The neighbours find this type of development very particularly contentious. They can give you an inside track on them on that knowledge basis as well. So they do serve a purpose, but they're not legally binding. And they'll always say the planning application process is the formal question and answer process. And a decision notice is the formal response of the planning authority.
What would you say are some challenges that designers face when dealing with the authorities?
It's being able to speak to them, to understand what they're doing and their communication. Local authorities are under-resourced, it's well publicised, has been the case for many years. The industry wants planning departments to be resourced so they can access them and provide well-rounded quality responses in good time. Delay and uncertainty lead to additional costs, which is just the worst thing for a client, isn't it? Mm. So the challenges is understanding their circumstances. There are good and bad planning officers and good and bad local authorities. But if you have that line of communication with them, don't pick your battles, pick your opportunities to ask the questions to them. They might not always be able to respond because they're very busy with lots of things. But it's having that accessibility to the officers, I think, is a key component in going on the journey to achieve the successful outcome.
Can I ask a question about listed?
Please do.
So you've got grade one, grade two, grade two star.
Grade two star, yes.
Is that it?
Those are the statutory designations.
What do they mean exactly?
They're the ranking of importance. And grade one would be the highest importance. You have ancient monuments as well, which are a whole further designation. But in reverse order, grade two star, grade two, and grade one. The assessment is made by the Secretary of State in collaboration with Historic England. And the Secretary of State will decide ultimately if a building is listed and what grade it should be. So listed buildings are listed if they are deemed to have any architectural or historic value. So you would need planning permission for works as defined by the Town and Country Planning Act, Section 55. Buildings are listed under planning legislation, but that's under a separate act. So you may need listed building consent to carry out any works of the fabric of that building. That also applies internally. So it is distinct from development and planning applications. So you may need to apply for listed building consent on works where you don't need planning permission, blocking, removing staircases, fireplaces, or creating openings, knocking about the fabric of a listed building internally. But you recall from Section 55, carrying out those works is not development in its own right. It doesn't require planning permission, but it may require listed building consent, most likely require listed building consent. So they're two distinct things which will go hand in hand and very important considerations to be aware of as early as possible.
And that's where Historic England get involved, isn't it?
The local authority will normally deal with listed building consent applications themselves, and they will consult with Historic England, and Historic England will often say they're not interested. It has to be of significant importance. Depends on the degree of importance of the building and the extent of assessment and what the intervention may be. So they're concerned moreover in perhaps the higher grade listing, buildings grade one, high degree of importance they'll get involved in. I've been involved in conversion of a grade one listed hospital in the past for residential, and Historic England were part of the consultation process on that pre-application stage. Clients will want to involve them if it's something is important and liaise with them.
Yeah.
I did a project a few years ago in Whittam. It's called AKA Restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really nice, really, really nice Asian fusion restaurant.
It's quite popular as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really popular. And that was a listed building. So we got an architect involved to help us with the planning on that. And it was really interesting because it was the fireplaces.
Yes.
There was about four fireplaces in this place, and they were beautiful old fireplaces, but one of them was right in the way. So we wanted to cover it up and put a bar in front of it.
Yes.
And they let us do it, but we had to keep the fireplace's integrity and cover it.
Yes.
And that was really interesting because we had a Historic England consultant or whoever.
Officer
come, and there was a lot of research done for the building, so the fabric of the building and the history of the building. It's really interesting when you dive into something.
Absolutely. On a scheme for the conversion of a former hotel. It's a vacant hotel, but it's grade two listed. It's been vacant for a while, and the client wants to convert it to residential apartments. So it's going to require a bit of knocking up. The layouts and the original room sizes are seen as important to the historic value of the property as well. And it has its historic architectural features that needs to be protected as much as possible. But due to the nature of the fire regulations, means of access and staircases need to be installed and they need to be compartmentalized. You can't have open staircases. So the location of those staircases is to be within the middle of a room, because the implications for the original joists, the conversations being had about moving it away from in front of a fireplace to better reveal that feature, part and components of the context of that fabric of that listed building, the enjoyment of that listed building, and moving that staircase, which will still need to be compartmentalized unless a secondary access means of escape can be provided. But move that away, and the officers are mindful potentially to accepting that the historic joists, fabric of the building, they may need to be cut away. But if that means that the scheme can be delivered to help preserve and secure the occupancy of this listed building, be at risk, they're willing to make that balance. Okay, that design intervention will be more acceptable than putting a staircase in the middle of the room, which will interfere with the appreciation of the historic fireplace. So that's an example of those negotiations and the importance within the fabric of the listed building.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because you do, one of the things, I love history. So always sort of loved it at school. And when you learn about the history of the building, it's so nice. It actually helps for me. It helps the interior design process as well. Because if I understand the history of the building, it then enables me to design around it as well. And like design with that in mind.
Absolutely. And that is something, the narrative around why you've come along by that certain design is something which is part of the story, the sales pitch, if you like, within a planning application. So you have justifications for schemes and the planning balance and what's important and what you're going to deliver and what the public benefits are. Part of that is selling the story, the narrative to the planners and to the conservation officers.
Yeah.
And they really do enjoy and appreciate that narrative about the historical context. Because buildings have evolved. Listed buildings may have been listed and then been added onto at certain points in time by building elements which would be listed. And they can be in quite significant contrast. The use of the word pastiche is something which is used often as justification to avoid some designs and that seek to mimic without going the full extent of the original buildings. And, you know, contrasting a design to the historic building can be successful, but it has to be architecturally acceptable and comply with certain principles. And it's a key point in time of what we did in the 21st century. And it has to be, you know, providing it's good quality design, it can be acceptable and justified. But it's that history, that storytelling, that's an important component as well. So I can understand before you say that, about what that means and how you do, how you bring forward designs as well.
It's so important that the architecture of the building and the interior design of the building needs to be joined, yeah. In my opinion. I mean, not everyone agrees with that, but I think that the way you design is really, really important.
But it does connect that. It does have implications to the building, and you need to make sure the design is cohesive with that, don't you?
It just makes it feel more authentic.
Yeah.
It makes you feel like you're in the right place.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
It all talks through. Yeah, it feels
character. It's having
genuine.
Yeah, it's having the actual historic characteristics of the building come alive, and that is what makes the building itself.
It's really exciting when those are incorporated in the skin. Mm-hmm. In buildings that are repurposed, and their use may have evolved over time, as is often the case, residential conversions being a great example. But in those historic buildings, maintaining those features of what it may have been an industrial use previously, the buildings are repurposed. And it's really exciting the way that designers do that, I find. It's really exciting coming up with innovative designs that respect the history and the context, but then look to the future as well.
Have you got any strategies for managing clients? We always like tips on managing clients. So, for example, if they've got a listed building and you know that it's going to be a delay more than they expected and potentially more cost, how would you manage that? Got any tips?
Try and be as honest with them as early as possible and forewarn them in advance. These are the issues that can potentially arise, and the implications on cost and delivery, you know, involving people. So it's that goes back to that research, that list in the first place, and yet informing them. We've all have clients who can be hands-on in good and bad ways, but I don't mind that. As long as you can talk them through it and they're involved in the process. It's the clients that perhaps were hands-off are the ones which I find most difficult, because you're trying to bring them in the tent a lot of the time to think about it. They may be brilliant at certain aspects commercially, and you know, planning won't be the thing that ticks their box. It's just a delaying process, but it's involving them in that thought process so that they are involved getting their decisions, because there's only so many decisions that you can make. You've got to have instructions from people.
Yeah, definitely.
On how to proceed. It's making them listen to the other consultants as well. No one wants to have unnecessary consultants in the process. People submit planning applications a lot of the time who aren't planning consultants because of the costs that we bring. You know, it's a fact, it's a reality. Sometimes we aren't required. People can go ahead and do things, you know, and it's been an unnecessary cost if they've involved us and other consultants as well. So you're always mindful of the commercial implications, and clients don't want to hear you continue saying, well, you need to spend this amount of money on that consultant there. They may need another report to the council.
Yeah.
But making them aware that they're going into, you know, an uncontrollable process going into planning. It's the decision maker, the council, who lead that process, as frustrating as it is. And not all councils, no two councils are the same. Priorities on council to council as well. Some councils aren't too bothered about having to provide certain reports in certain areas.
Yeah.
But it's just making them aware of the implications, really, about the cost and delay. Getting things sorted as soon as possible.
Yeah,
will speed up the process later down the line. Yeah.
Are there any common misconceptions about planning within the interior design industry?
Well, I can only presume that there are. Talking as an ex authority officer and dealing with responses of people as soon as you tell them that you're a town planner, obviously people think that they're overly bureaucratic, they are slow, don't appreciate commercial sensitivities, and even corrupt to a certain degree. I would always say that local authority officers are not corrupt. You may perceive that they may be inept. I don't want to really use that word because lots of my...
What does inept? You're teaching me some good words today. What does inept mean?
Going right in my dictionary.
not necessarily on the brief entirely. I don't want to really use that because I have lots of good friends who were still local authority officers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a local authority officer for 12 years and I used to defend to the hilt local authorities and I will do. Yeah, good and bad local authorities, as I mentioned. The perceptions are you're going to a black hole. If you can do your research and maintain that relationship and get some form of relationship with those officers, then you can hopefully show the officers that you have got good intentions, not to over-egg certain elements. Don't waste their time. Don't bombard them with emails. Don't tell them their job. Don't tell them what to do. You will go to the bottom of the pile very easily. There'll be a big pile of things that they need to do.
It sounds like you've got some experience within that. A little bit of experience.
When you worked at local authority, when you had a phone on your desk and the phone went, before mobile phones told you who was calling, and I enjoyed answering that phone. You didn't know who it was going to be. The counsellor who was really going to put you on the spot about a certain application, and you had to, you know, have your wits about you and provide a straight responses. Could be a neighbouring consultee, or it could be a resident, could be very challenging. It's funny, the smaller the scale of application, such as an extension to someone's house, the more personal they are. And those can be the most emotional and emotionally challenging for people as well. So it's appreciating people's circumstances. I had a lot of tears on the phone coming down for me, which is, I don't want to say just the job, but it's kind of part of your job, isn't it? I've got to be divorced, separate myself from the emotions when you're a local authority officer as well. So they won't be emotional about it. They've got a lot to deal with. The challenges are the next email these days, and getting council officers to respond to your emails as well can be very difficult because they don't have the contact numbers anymore. They don't have the phone on the desk. They're working from home. They don't have council mobile phone numbers. Contact details aren't available anymore on their email addresses. Back in the day,
I've noticed that quite a lot, and not just with planning. With so many people, I go to call them, and I'm like, they don't have their phone number in the email.
I feel like everybody should be made to put their phone number on there.
But that's the thing we do, and we get so many calls.
And, you know, it can be a real challenge to engage with them.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Definitely.
I've heard a lot about biodiversity net gain, is it?
Yes, that's right.
What does that mean?
So there's new environmental legislation that came into force earlier on this year. And it's a basic requirement that all development sites, all planning applications have got to assess what the existing biodiversity value of a site is. And if there is biodiversity on the site, you are required to improve on that value by 10%.
So what does biodiversity value? Is that plants?
Effectively. Plants, right. Plants, insects, animals, flora and fauna. Mm. So an ecologist are best placed to carry out or provide the advice on it. And they ultimately would need to conduct a survey of what the existing ecological value, if you wish, the biodiversity value of that site is. Now, obviously, the larger the site, the more the site includes existing landscaping, the more likelihood that it will have a higher degree of biodiversity. So if you're in the countryside and you're looking to carry out works and a planning application that includes the red outline, which is the planning application site, includes countryside or even in the town centre, they can be what's known as open mosaic sites, where derelict sites or grown, they will have a high biodiversity. They're a thriving home to insects and wildlife. So it's the aspiration to address the reduction in biodiversity in the environment, to use development then to increase that biodiversity, to put something back. The aspiration of a target is a minimum of 10%.
So you add 10%.
Add biodiversity.
So what happens if you want to build on a field then?
You're going to have to really work hard. Innovative innovative designs. This is where landscapers and ecologists are becoming a lot of teams, one and the same. So it's part of that design process. And we're advising clients that it's going to inform the design at inception. How are you going to include significant areas of gaping? And what is the design of that SAF landscaping? Because certain species will have a higher value than others, be they in flora and fauna. So this is where the input of an ecologist is required at an early stage to provide that advice. It's indicative of, unfortunately, how planning has become over the last couple of decades. So much more money is required on consultants to provide more detailed recommendations and assessments at an early stage, at design stage. But historically, they would be covered under condition, but they go to the core of the principle these days of whether the scheme is acceptable or not, not in whether it's an add-on that can be covered by a condition to submit at a future stage. So just touching on the conditions I advise you about, conditions can lead to delays. You get your planning permission, but then there will be conditions attached that you will need to comply with. And a condition application is a formal application, which will, in theory, take 8 weeks to determine. That's the target date. There's a lead-in time to collate the information that's required to submit that application as well. So where you can include that information at the planning application stage as much as possible, you can avoid, hopefully then, too many conditions being attached. It's inevitable that you'll get conditions on there that require you to submit information that can be either prior to commencement of the scheme, which is the worst case scenario, prior to the carrying out of that particular element of the works. That's occupancy, for example, but you will need to secure those conditions before the scheme ultimately can be signed off. So those are important aspects that to be aware of. And that's where you're alive to what the consultation responses are that come in during the course of a planning application, what the policy requirements are as well. When you're submitting a planning condition application, then you can include as many conditions on that one application as you wish, but our advice would always be submit them separately. Because if there's one element of those details that you're submitting are unacceptable, the whole application will be refused potentially.
Yeah.
And you're back to square one again. So submit them individually, treat them as land and conquer, tick them off. So there may be, depending on the complexity of the scheme and how many conditions and details you need to submit, but you hope to just narrow it down and limit it then. And you can work on those. And it's far more manageable as well. It's not so too overwhelming if you've got to try and deal with too many conditions and you've got too many plates spinning.
Yeah.
Whilst you're trying to manage the project and the client's expectations and all these other issues.
Are you having, when we were at this construction networking event, there was a couple of people really moaning about the fact that you need an ecologist now.
Yes.
And it's causing a lot more delays. Is that what you're experiencing?
Absolutely. There's been a massive spike in demand for ecologists. They're in demand. And then, so of course, their costs and fees are going to go up. We're being quoted 2-3 months lead-in time.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. To provide their reports. And
so if you're looking at a career and you want to be an ecologist, it's probably a good place to be at the moment.
At the moment, yes. There's also only particular windows when you can carry out particular surveys on particular species. Bat roosting surveys, for example, they can only take place from May to September, I think it is. So if a local authority needs to provide a bat roosting survey with this planning application, we can't determine it now, and it's
October.
Exactly.
And you've got to wait till next year. Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
So that's the forward thinking, forward planning. How you deal with that challenge and how you negotiate that challenge. And try, there, the classic example, you try and get that as a condition. Hopefully it's not imperative. It doesn't go to the core of the suitability, the assessment of the suitability of that scheme. But these are things you need to take into account of. But ecologists, yes, trying to get hold of them and get them to reliably respond is a challenge because they're in demand. Got contact with lots of good ecologists. You know, but they're being very honest and saying there's 2-3 months lead in times with these things. Unfortunately, they're overworked at the moment. So yes, there are those delays, but the design, go back to the design scheme has got to incorporate the potential future-proof. Really, really important.
Is there any advice you would like the people that are listening to remember and take from this podcast today?
Yes. Well, there's sustainability and energy, which are very important players as well. And local authorities will ask for technical information, technical details.
Yeah.
And the amount of carbon emissions from development is very much a key material plan consideration. So factor those in as well.
Yeah. I know really
you've
important.
Had you've had people speaking about that in the past, and it really does apply locations. Rely upon the resource that you have. Involve consultants, get a network of consultants you can rely upon as well. If you need to involve a scheme designer or an architect, etc., their breadth of knowledge knows no bounds, in all honesty. When it comes to fire safety, secure by design, wheelchair accessibility. Yeah. Those key components as well. Planning is secondary legislation. Those other matters, usually primary legislation, so they come first. But you still need to get your planning permissions in place if needs be. But it's being sensitive and aware of what the requirements are, I think, is key.
Yeah.
I think as a designer, I don't think I'm qualified to do planning, even though people have expected me to, and you don't have to be qualified. Mm. But it's such a minefield. And
there is so much you need to know.
And you think that something's going to be really simple. You know, I've been doing advertising consent planning, and most of the time it's really easy.
But it then should be.
But sometimes you get that.
And then I got one that was just a nightmare.
Went on and on.
And you just don't know. And you know, I think if you would have picked that up, you would have seen it straight away. But because I've not got that, the experience that you've got,
It's the experience.
That means that the application's been rejected. And that goes, like you say, that goes on me, really. Yeah. You know, I don't want to be getting rejected planning applications. So I would always now recommend a planning consultant.
This music's my ears.
It's a pain in the ass, and I'm a designer. I'm not a planning consultant, so I don't know I do that not very often.
It is a complete pain in the ass. I can tell you that with 25 years experience. There's not going to be ever a perfect process, and there's a big balance because you've got the challenges of satisfying all of the people all the time. It's an impossibility.
Yeah.
But it is that balance because we've got to progress, and we've got to keep on moving forwards, haven't we? We've got to provide houses for people. We've got to support, protect people's immunity at the end of the day, and make a sustainable environment as much for people, makes it as easy for people to live in as possible without the world becoming even more difficult.
Definitely. A sustainable future.
That's key.
How can our audience get in touch with you or learn more about Carney Sweeney's work?
Well, I'm out there on all the appropriate resources online. Carney Sweeney's website is accessible. My contact details are on Carney Sweeney's webpage. I'm obviously on LinkedIn. Try to be as active as possible. If I have downtime on there, it's probably because it's got lots of work to do, which is no bad thing. But it's a valuable resource, LinkedIn.
Yeah.
My contact details are on there. Richard Evans, town planner, Carney Sweeney.
I'll put all of your details in the notes as well, so people can click through.
Thank you very much. But yeah, we're there to field all sorts of queries, hopefully assist people. And if we can identify something which people can deal with themselves, don't need to burden themselves with our fees or time, and we'll seek to assist people there. Obviously, everyone's looking to tailor their cloth accordingly, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you.
You are a wealth of knowledge.
I feel like I am just overstimulated with so much information right now. My brain is going to explode, but good knowledge.
Yeah.
I've definitely learned a lot of things today, and I'm sure that everyone listening has learned a lot as well.
I hope so. It's a never-ending knowledge basis when it comes to town planning, and every day's a school day. We're always learning, aren't we? From our experiences and the experiences of others. But planning doesn't stand still, and that's also perhaps one key takeaway.
Yeah.
Doesn't stand still. Policy, legislation, case law, it all changes. Yeah. And it's a movable feast. Mm. So we've just got to be alive to that and navigate our way through it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much
to Platform Events who have kindly supplied us our lounge to have our podcast in today. And we wanted to just give the Watchers group a mention as well, because she's given us some cushion.
And
which go very well on this sofa.
They are. You can only see them if you are watching. So maybe give us a watch as well.
Yes.
But we have been gifted these beautiful cushions. I would definitely have a look at their website. They are lovely.
And very much for joining us. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.